Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road when along came a semi with a high and canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Of travel I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Fidelia. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Grumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Well, thank you very much, Audrey, and as I've said many times before, my, how you exaggerate, but thank you very much for getting us connected and hooked up on the show again tonight. We have an interesting guest via video, and it's going to be Chief Gerald Gates, Daryl Gates from the Los Angeles Police Department, who spent more than 30 years in policing, and we're going to have him talk to us for about 40 minutes, and he's going to be discussing his career, particularly the events and what happened after the Rodney King case in California, which was an atrocious case. I did some writing about it. I couldn't believe my eyes what I was seeing those police officers do in that particular circumstance. But anyway, he'll be talking about that, and then, of course, what happened when the Los Angeles police officers were acquitted of the charges against them, and of course they took the case then to federal court. So it's going to be interesting. And as the gentleman who introduces Chief Gates will say, a whole person's career shouldn't be judged by what happened in a particular part of it. And Daryl Gates certainly made some major contributions to the Los Angeles Police Department, and they've consistently had high quality chiefs over the years. Anyway, welcome to the Blog Talk Radio Network and the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm your host, Keith Haley, and thank you again to Johnny Cash. He took us through those 90 cities and states. If you heard the whole song, and what a marvelous feat it is for somebody to be able to sing that song from memory. In fact, I've barely got my ukulele laid down here when I was strumming along with that, but don't want you to ever have to hear that. Emily and Mike, thank you very much for joining us tonight. Thank you for doing us a little special news work tonight. We're trying to mix in Google Notebook and Evernote in terms of retrieving and filing our news, and it didn't work out exactly like we planned, but we never give up. The purpose of our show is what it always is. This is show number 176, by the way. Can you believe that? 176 shows. Harold, my goldfish, he just fainted when he heard that. He went to the bottom of the bowl. Oh, he's okay. What we do on the show, though, is we discuss news issues, events, and major developments in the always difficult and sometimes humorous practice of criminal justice. And it is humorous, and we've got some new ones tonight based on our new, I was going to play the former Soviet national anthem, but I thought I shouldn't, based on the new health care bill that was passed earlier this week. I'm trying to figure out if there were about 4,400 20-some felonies right now, according to Harvey Silverglade's book, Three Felonies a Day. I wonder how many the healthcare legislation adds. I'm guessing 100. What would you say, Mike? You're saying 150. Okay. Could be more than that, but we'll have to see. But there's some interesting things in there that people don't know about, including some who voted for it, who are just finding some of this out. Of course, it doesn't go to full fruition for something like 10 years, but many of the things start here in 2011. Our show is dedicated to those tireless police, courts, corrections, and juvenile justice professionals who protect us throughout the United States and indeed throughout the world. What we try to do is look inside criminal justice and take a close-up look at the professional practice. The show coming up here, I haven't booked him yet, but he's been on the show before. There's a new program in federal probation, and I think what I'm going to do, I'm going to a graduation ceremony here very shortly of some federal probationers, felons, of course, who have committed crimes and gone through a very special program. That's all I'm going to say about it. And I'm going to the graduation, and I'm looking forward to that. And I think the director of that program we may have on the show here coming pretty quick. You're listening on Blog Talk Radio. And again, is it leading edge technology or what? But Alan Levy is the CEO of BTR, and he's the genius behind the medium, as I say. And he's now up to the point where there are 29 or 30,000 shows a week. And what that means is that any person, any organization, any group of people can have their own show. They can broadcast live and streaming audio over the Internet worldwide to an unlimited number of listeners. And it's absolutely free. It doesn't cost anything. And, you know, if you were buying this in radio time, it would cost a fortune. People are catching on. I see when they do the ads, when you just go to blogtalkradio.com, you'll see a picture of a bunch of people sitting up there in the front. At least once in a while they run that across the top, and there will be President Obama. He's wise enough to figure out that Blog Talk Radio is a good deal, too. So our shows are archived almost immediately after they're recorded, and you can download those. There's no copyright on those whatsoever. You can use them however you would like to do that. So get your own show. It's really worth it, and many of you have things out there to say, things you want to do, and this would be the way to do it. If you're interested in politics and community organizing and things like that, I couldn't think of anything much better than taking a look at that sort of thing. Well, tonight let's take a little look here at a few things like some criminal justice news. We'll be doing that pretty quick, and I told you what our show guest is going to be talking about, the Los Angeles Police Department and his career. If you choose to call in during the news show, you can do it at 347-996-5983. That's 347-996-5983, and we can hold five callers at a time should anybody ever want to call. Audrey, I think you have a blonde joke tonight. This will be your 176th blonde joke. You know what that's telling me? It sounds like you're ready for a book of blonde jokes. What do you think? I think you could do it. Audrey England, author of the book. Well, what do you got for us tonight?
Professor Haley, tonight we take a poke at government workers who do great things for us. But this blonde joke is about a blonde supervisor working in a useful government service. Here it is. A blonde government supervisor called in a subordinate regarding his failure to complete his last task. The blonde said, "Sam, see, you only converted 4 out of the 5 books I asked you to convert to Braille. As you know, our state needs to make our publications available to everyone, including the blind." Sam said, "Yes, of course. I understand." Then the blonde supervisor said, "So what happened with that 5th book?" Sam replied, "You mean the automobile driving manual?"
All right, I like that one. Mike likes that one too. Very good. The driving manual. Don't want to do that one in Braille. I don't think. But who knows? In the very near future, wouldn't that be something if the unsighted, the blind could, in fact, be able to move around and protect themselves and everybody else if something like that would work. Don't put it past our scientific capability here in the United States to do something like that. But we have a green tip for tonight, and I must I must admit this is one that I never thought of doing. I mean, I know this is important in terms of saving the planet, and that I thought global warming was here today when everything had been melted, but I see it snowing again tonight up here in northwest Ohio. But this one I'd never thought of. Here it is from Esma Floyd's 1001 Little Ways to Save the Planet. And here's one that you could do. And then I'm going to ask a question about this after I'm finished. This one's called tip number 490 in living pots. Instead of buying new, old-look pots, in other words, pots that look old, you can age your current terracotta containers by covering them in yogurt every other evening for a few weeks to encourage lichens. Yep, you don't get it? You put yogurt on your pots every other evening, and then eventually they'll look old. Now, I'm trying to figure out what that got to do with saving energy and saving the planet, but there must be some connection there. Some of these I can't figure out. You know, it takes a scientist to figure out, you know, Al Gore. Al Gore could explain all those things. But anyway, that's an interesting little green tip. Then I think we also need to think about tonight, especially the Ohio Coalition Against Firearms. They have a public service announcement they would like you to hear, and we've been faithful to play this announcement for several years now. And what they're trying to do is get the street criminals to lay down their guns, come down, better yet, come down and turn them into the police department. And here's what they're interested in doing. You can listen to this, and it will relate to our first news story.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. Message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
Now, the Ohio Coalition, I think, is directing that message towards street criminals. They certainly could mean concealed carry license holders. I wouldn't think that would be the case. But anyway, what we're going to do tonight is take a look at this first news story that relates to carrying a concealed weapon. Ohio continues to struggle with the issue of how should someone who's gone through the training and gotten a certificate to carry a concealed weapon, the firearm, pistol, how should they in fact carry that in an automobile? And Ohio went through some very strange things initially, but they had a meeting yesterday, the Senate Judiciary Criminal Justice Committee, and they were considering that very thing, Senate Bill 239, and they're trying to straighten out some things. They're saying that this would eliminate, this new bill, the current confusing standards of carrying a firearm in a motor vehicle. In addition, the proposal would also allow permit holders to carry a firearm for self-defense in a restaurant that serves alcohol, provided they're not consuming the alcohol, thus eliminating another victim zone in Ohio. Victim zone, that's an interesting term. That's a pro-CCW carry term. But anyway, in Ohio, you can't take, among other restricted areas, you can't carry a concealed firearm with your license into any place that serves alcohol. In Texas, you can do it as long as the alcohol establishment doesn't make more than 50% of its profits from alcohol. In other words, you can go to, you know, TGIF and places like that that serve wine, beer, whiskey here. But Ohio is recommending this. First of all, in terms of carrying the thing in the car, Ohio had a weird law. You had to wear the thing on your person, invisible. In other words, it had to be seen by anybody that would look in the car, meaning the police officer. That's what they were concerned about. Or it had to be locked up, like in the glove box or the glove compartment. Well, they finally changed that. Oh no, it could also have been on a stand that you bought and put on your dashboard. A locked pistol would be on your dashboard so everybody could look in and see that you had a pistol on your dashboard. Didn't make much sense, did it? Well, they finally changed that. The current law, here's what it says. You can carry it in a holster secured on your person. This is in your vehicle. You can carry it in a closed case, bag, box, or other container that's in plain sight and that has a lid, a cover, or some closing mechanism with a zipper, snap, or buckle, which must be open for a person to gain access to the gun. So it doesn't have to be locked up anymore. Or the loaded gun is securely encased by being stored in a closed glove compartment or center console in a case, or in a case that is locked. But the glove box, I think, now does not have to be locked anymore. A locked case does not need to be in plain sight. An unlocked case does, so the cop can see that, the officer can see that you have a case there, and you're supposed to tell them anyway when they stop you. So what they want to do to move forward on this is stop people from being accidentally carrying the firearm in a prohibited manner. It's a little confusing. And a lot of this is a big to-do about nothing. But anyway, we'll have to see. I'm going to look up and see what happened in that Senate hearing yesterday. But the Senate Judiciary Criminal Justice Committee is meeting on that very thing. Let's take a look at some of these other news stories this week. Some of them are interesting. CDC's looks like medical marijuana users in district may not have to go to a clinic or doctor's office. Isn't that nice to get their dose? They'll be able to do it in their backyard. The D.C. Council is thinking of adding a provision to the new medical marijuana bill that would allow some users to grow plants for their own use. They'd likely be limited to two plants. Now, that's severely limiting because other states allow them to grow, let me see what it says here, 13 states permit home cultivation, and most states allow people to cultivate five or six plants. How many plants do you need? I wouldn't have any idea about that. But anyway, it'll be interesting to see. I didn't realize that many states actually permitted the growing of medical marijuana on your own. The FBI started something interesting here the other day. They teamed up with a private organization, which I think is out of Dallas, if I'm not mistaken. And they put up a website called Bandit Tracker Northeast. And what this does, it has video pictures and still shots of all the bank robberies that have occurred in New Jersey and New York. Hey, and it's quite a few pages if you get to take a look at it, but it's Bandit Tracker Northeast. I love to look at some of these pictures of these bandits because some of them don't have much sense about what they're doing. Some of them look bored. A few of them have a pistol in their hand. The others probably have it in their pocket or something like that. But take a look at that image. And the idea is this is the web version of the wanted poster. And, of course, many more people can see it. And the FBI has its own site, by the way. Of course, FBI.gov. And on that, they have a section there about people that they're looking for. And several months ago, I mentioned it on the show, they had the guy that the red-haired guy that had robbed like 20 banks. And I think that's quite a few because the FBI used to nail you. Of course, they're diverted into other areas now and probably don't have the staff to work on bank robberies like they used to. Postal inspectors investigate bank robberies, too, because if there's mail in the post office, that gives the postal inspectors jurisdiction, too. But anyway, we're trying to stop bank robbery, and we would think at this particular point in time with unemployment and all that, some crazy people get the idea that they want to do this. The bank robbers that get away from this, as I recall from years ago, are the ones that, live out in a suburb somewhere and decide I want to one time go rob a bank and get a lot of money and then never do it again. And sometimes those are the hardest ones to trace and to find. Let me roll down here past this story about a private guard for the first time has shot a Somali pirate. Did you know that? Gee, it's about time somebody shot a Somali pirate, right? But now they're taking flak over this. A Somali pirate was in a clash that left two skiffs riddled with bullet holes. My, my, that's terrible that you'd want to shoot somebody that wants to take over your ship. But it seems like it would be pretty easy to defend against people on a little short boat coming toward a big ship. But I know these shippers do not allow guns on their, do not allow guns ordinarily on their, with their crews. So that's interesting. India's military is coming up with a weapon that is based on the hottest chili. Have you heard about that? They're going to have a grenade type of thing that's actually using the hottest chili pepper in the world. and this thing I just has burned your eyes so much that you just have to take off. It's an effective non-toxic weapon, but its pungent smell can choke terrorists and force them out of their hideouts. Isn't that nice? Instead of shooting a terrorist or throwing a hand grenade in, now we can run them out with chili peppers. I love that idea. You can't beat it. Well, ladies and gentlemen, you probably saw with the health care bill that we're still combing through it and trying to figure out what's there. Of course, the intentions of this were certainly the best, health care for all. But buried deep in the health care legislation that the president signed this past Tuesday is a new requirement that will affect every American who walks into a McDonald's, a Starbucks, a Burger King, et cetera, don't mean to cut anybody out, but every big restaurant chain in the nation will now be required to put calorie information on their menus and drive-thru signs. So that means, in other words, for example, as soon as 2011, it will be impossible to chomp down on a Big Mac without knowing that it contains over 500 calories, more than a quarter of the Agriculture Department's 2,000-calorie daily guideline. I didn't know the Agriculture Department had guidelines for us. How about that? Now, you know, I'm reading that book, and I had to send my Sony reader back in for a second time, but Sony's a wonderful company. It's a long explanation. But they wanted a recall on something, asked for it. They pay for everything, and they have it back in days. But anyway, I'm reading that Three Felonies a Day by Harvey Silverglade, and he had said that there was something like 3,420 felonies already. I wonder how many new felonies this health care bill with its pervasive scope will add to the business. See, one of the things you get charged with there is this business of making a false statement. And remember, under the federal guidelines, you can unintentionally make a false statement, just make a mistake. That's still a federal felony. So if you say your Big Mac, it's really 520 calories, and you say that it's 620, you overestimate it, you're actually committing a crime. Isn't that something? But pretty soon, we will be able to tell exactly. Remember, Mayor Bloomberg in New York has done this for at least a year or more, and they found out through the sales that people are eating more, not less. Maybe people feel they need more calories, but I just can't believe it. And look out for the future. My solution to all this is, of course, they're doing the same thing in schools. There's now going to be a national school menu, not by choice, that certain foods and fats and content will not be allowed to be served, I mean, over those limits. But the liquid celery trough can't be far off. That's really the answer. We don't have to mess around with all these other things. I wonder what the new Calorie Police will wear as a uniform. What would that be like a chef uniform with a badge, or I'm not sure. I'm going to finish with this story. I've got a lot of new stuff, but it's a long clip that I'll be playing with Chief Daryl Gates. But California, of course, we've mentioned it before in the last several months, is in a severe budget crunch. And one of the ways of getting some more money and redirecting it to better uses is to reduce prison overcrowding. The state's begun here in the recent weeks the most significant changes, this article in the New York Times says, since the 1970s to produce overcrowding. And they chip away at an astonishing 70% recidivism rate. That's the highest in the country. Recidivism means a repeat offender, but it's a very complicated term and research article. You have to be sure that you understand. You know, if you work for a drug rehab program and they never come back to you after you treat them, they go out and become the worst drug addict they could ever be and get sent to some other place, that doesn't count as a recidivist. But by recidivist, they generally mean here in California, I've been to prison, I went out, committed more crimes, and came back to prison. But, of course, you could go out and commit more crimes and get probation or get your parole type for something like that. Or I could go to another state and commit a crime, which would be counted in recidivism rates. Or I could go do a federal crime as opposed to a local. It gets very, very complicated. When somebody tells you about a recidivism rate, just be real cautious because it's very, very complicated. Anyway, about 11% of the state budget, or roughly $8 billion, goes to the penal system. And what they're interested in doing, they're talking about strains on the system are evident inside the state prison here, about 50 miles north of Los Angeles, where 4,600 inmates fill buildings intended for half that many. Emily, do you have a tissue? A stuffy, cacophonous gymnasium houses nearly 150 people in triple bunk beds, stretching wall to wall. I think I remember those on ships, like 7 or 8 high. I've been on the next to the last to the top several times, and but not for prisoners. We would want anything like that for prisoners. They're actually in a gym floor sleeping. Isn't that terrible? But anyway, California's going to turn them loose. The goal is to reduce the number of inmates in the state's 33 prisons by 6,500, more than the entire population in 2009 of Nebraska and New Mexico, or prison population of those other states, which is a meaningless statistic. All in all, there are 67,000 prisoners in California. I would have actually thought it was more than that. That's about 3 times what Ohio has, I think. Anyway, people in criminal justice are looking to see what will happen. I bet you can't predict that there will be more time, could you? Letting people are going to shorten sentences, let people off for finishing programs, all kinds of things are going to release them into the community. So it'll be fun to watch because it took us a long time to figure out that we should be locking up criminals. And our crime rates, yes, last year were the lowest in 50 years in the United States, a half century. And some say they're the lowest that we've ever had since we've been counting crime. So California will be a leader in that regard, as it is in many other ways. Their death row, by the way, also, they have about 670, almost 670 on death row. There's a story in here about that serial killer, Richard Ramirez, who went out and killed 13 different people. He did this in 82 or something like that, and he's still on death row, still making appeals. He's not dead yet. And the reporter talks about the symbolic death row in California. They don't have a death row. But isn't that interesting? He won't be put to death now. He's scheduled to die when he's 71 years old. And he committed these crimes when he was in his mid-20s. He may not even be able to remember why he's being executed, but I'm sure someone else will. That a man could sit nearly 50 years on death row now isn't surprising. And, of course, the appeal will be what? This is unfair. You should have executed him earlier. And I'm sure they'll be pulling that if they haven't already. Well, anyway, that's our news segment tonight. And what we want to look at now is Chief Daryl Gates in California, who left the office prior to Chief Bratton coming there. And Daryl Gates was certainly a professional. He has over 30 years in law enforcement, and he really lived through some rough times at the helm of the Los Angeles Police Department, which has very high standards, one of the best training programs in the country, but they got sort of off on a wrong track. I could go on and on about that. I know people that have written articles. Betsy McNulty wrote a study of the car-to-car traffic message that was going on for years, things that wouldn't have been allowed in another police department whatsoever. So L.A. lost it for a while, and I think when Bill Bratton got back out there, who just left, by the way, they got back on track. So here we go with Chief Daryl Gates talking about some tough times at the helm of the Los Angeles Police Department.
That would allow for reorganization of the police department. It's called Carter Amendment S. And now Mr. Gates remarks before a meeting of the Town Hall of California.
When a public figure becomes involved in controversy, we often identify him or her only with that controversy. Those that disagree with whatever he or she did ignore that person's contributions and career and focus only on recent events. In other words, just like a financial statement, you can't look at only the liability side or the most recent statement to determine performance. Chief Daryl Gates, our guest, may be a victim of this practice. It must be remembered that Chief Gates, at considerable personal sacrifice, has been a public servant for over 40 years. If someone casts blame upon him for recent events, whether right or wrong, he is also entitled to credit for his accomplishments over a 40-year period. Also, if we look at an issue, we can disagree without personalizing the matter. One can disagree with Chief Gates on an issue such as Proposition F without demonizing him. The same is true for the other side. Darrell Gates was born in Glendale and raised in Highland Park. He grew up in poverty, graduated Franklin High School, served in the Navy, and attended USC. It is said he wanted to be a lawyer. I don't know why, but he needed money, and so he joined the police force in 1949. He became a protege of Chief William Parker, a no-nonsense chief of police who made the LAPD a modern, professional, and corrupt-free police force. Thus, Chief Parker was instrumental in the progress of Officer Gates through a variety of important assignments. Chief Gates also continued to advance during the reigns of Chief Tom Redden and Ed Davis. He developed the concept for SWAT, Special Weapons and Tactics, a unit that is now used around the world to counter terrorist attacks. One who reaches the top of LAPD, just like any organization, has to excel throughout the years. Promotion in the Los Angeles Police Department is in large part based on objective evaluations and tests. So by the time Chief Gates was selected to become chief, he established and had an outstanding career of public service. He became chief in 1978 and had to face the problems of dealing with increasing crime with less money, caused in part by Proposition 13. It is ironic that all of the politicians, from presidents to prosecutors, who run for office on a theme of fighting crime, went in office too little to support crime prevention or law enforcement. Thus, the LAPD is one of the smallest big city police departments per capita. Yet Chief Gates was innovative and dealt with this. For example, he developed the CARE program, and he received worldwide respect for his handling of the policing of the 1984 Olympic Games. In the 1990 classic work called Beyond 9/11, Professor Sparrow Moran Kennedy of the Kennedy School at Harvard said, and I'd like to quote, "Darrell Gates of the Los Angeles Police Department is in many ways the epitome of the reformed police chief, and his department a shining example of the best in reformed policing. He has had a long and distinguished service in the department he now leads. He is an articulate and passionate champion of the reform model of honest professional crime control as the central mission of policing. Gates' department mirrors his values. It operates with a high degree of autonomy, discipline, and self-confidence. For four decades, it has avoided major corruption scandals. It polices a vast terrain and varied population with half the officers per capita of some big city department. It boasts sophisticated technical specialties rivaling the expertise of much larger organizations." Close quote. And the Christopher Commission report stated, in a passage which is often overlooked, Chief of Police Darrell Gates has been a Los Angeles police officer for 42 years, having risen through the ranks to his present position. He has achieved a noteworthy record of public service in a stressful and demanding profession. Under his leadership, the department has maintained a national reputation for innovation, efficiency, and honesty." Close quote. I give you Chief of Police Darrell Gates.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for that reception, and certainly thank you, Richard, for that introduction. I wish you'd have read some of that when you were on the Christopher Commission. I appreciated that. You did read the one good line out of that report, and I appreciate your picking that one good line out of there, because so many have read all of the other stuff that's in that report. And I came here originally as I was asked to be here was to talk in opposition to Proposition F, and so much has occurred since that time. I'm not sure that I really want to get too deeply involved in that subject. I think I'm going to let the voters of this city make up their minds, and unfortunately I think many of them have already made up their minds. And I say unfortunately because I think that to vote for that is a major mistake. And it kind of follows along with the kind of leadership that we have received in the city for a long period of time, that I think if you just look around you, and even if you just look back a couple of weeks and see the kind of devastation that occurred here in this city, you get some sense of some of the failures in leadership in this city. And if you look at some of the others, it's not hard to find them. We are in debt in the city. We cannot meet our budget this year. We cannot meet the basic needs of this community. Almost everywhere you look, there is a lack of infrastructure, both in terms of the brick-and-mortar infrastructure that's needed. You can't fill potholes. You can't trim trees. You can't do so many things in this city. Then the lack of social infrastructure that exists in the city. And so I just tell you that you can follow on with that lack of leadership and follow on by voting for Proposition F. If you believe that what we've been doing in the past is the right path, I don't think it is. And I'm only going to spend a couple of minutes on it, and then your chairman asked me about questions and answers, and I'm certainly for those. As a matter of fact, I'd like to get to those as quickly as possible because I think that gets to those things that are on your mind, and that's most important to me, and I hope we can answer some of your questions as you ask them. First of all, let me just say this about Proposition F. What you're voting on really is a major issue. It's a change in the fundamental law of this city, just like any change in the Constitution. And while there may be some issues in that that are something we could all agree on, and there probably are because some of it I do agree with, what the city council has done, like a lot of the leadership that is done in the city, is wide in the city, they grouped all the good things with the bad things and said, take it or leave it. Don't be discriminating, folks. Don't be discriminating because we don't think you can do that. We don't think you're that discriminating to pick out the good things and the bad things, so we're going to give it all to you in book form. And you just vote yay or nay. And I think they did that because they looked at the history of voting in the city and they realized that the leadership of the city was voted in by about 17% of the voting public. That says a great deal about our interest in going to the ballot box and taking these issues head on and ascertaining whether or not there is truth in them and whether there is worth in them and then making a judgment. That is an extremely important proposal, and what you get on the ballot is a very, very small item. This is the proposal, folks. Highly complex, highly involved, making major changes in the fundamental law of the city of Los Angeles, not that. Most of the people who go to the ballot box will look on there and they will say, ah, this is something the Christopher Commission suggested we vote for, so we're going to vote for it. We don't really know what's in it. We don't know whether there's reform in it or not. That's what they said we ought to vote for, and that's what we're going to vote for. I think that's a mistake. I think it's a mistake, and I think the city council is relying on folks not being discriminating and relying on the fact that they could just label it as police reform, and people will vote for it. And I submit to you that it is not police reform. It is the kind of thing that we have in Chicago and New York and all of the eastern cities that have done just the reverse of what Richard Mosk has said. They have created departments that were politically controlled and politically manipulated, and the corruption in the within those departments is rampant. Part of history. Everyone looks at Chicago. Everyone looks at New York. Everyone looks at those eastern cities and said, "Well, it's just part of doing business in those cities." It's part of what we expect from our police. And you don't expect that and have not expected that from the Los Angeles Police Department for a long period of time, but I can tell you this. You vote this in and that's what you can expect. And all you have to do is just go just a little bit north of here in San Francisco if you want to look at politics entering into the police department. They can't keep a police chief up there for over 40 days. And they decide they don't know whether they want him to be strong or not strong. Or they don't have the slightest idea what they want. All they know is that politics enters into it, and the mayor may be embarrassed. And if the mayor is embarrassed, let's get rid of that chief. And that's what this provides for. It talks about five-year terms. There's nothing wrong with five-year terms. As a matter of fact, I look back at my career, and a couple of five-year terms would have been plenty for me. As a matter of fact, as I look at 10 years in this business, it's plenty for anyone. And you get to be 14 years in this business, you get to be like me. And no one wants that. So 10 years is fine. There's nothing wrong with that, but there is no assurance of 10 years. You can be fired by the mayor, regardless of what anybody says about this. You can be fired by the mayor in 44 days, or 50 days, or 60 days, or a year. There's no five-year term. And then they say, well, there's an assurance because the city council has to approve of this. No, folks. All you need is the mayor and six votes. A mayor and six votes. That's all you need. I've got six votes in the council right now for almost any issue. And any mayor that doesn't have six votes is not a mayor. And I don't know of a mayor in the history, the long history that I've been around, that wouldn't have six votes for an important issue. So that's what you've got. You've got politics and manipulating the chief of police. If you can manipulate the chief of police, you go right down to the bottom level. And that's what happens in major cities across the nation, right down to the bottom level. San Francisco, for many, many years, you could not become a detective. Inspectors, they call them there. You could not become an inspector unless your name was passed through City Hall, through the mayor's office, and stamped with approval. And I talk to my colleagues across the nation, and I hear the kinds of things that they have to put up with their leadership and some of the feelings that they have, and I ask them, why don't you speak out about those things? They say, I can't. I can't speak out. How can I speak out? My mayor will fire me tomorrow. And think about it, folks. Think about it. Do you know another chief of police in the United States that speaks out? Have you heard of another chief in the United States that speaks out? No, you don't. So what will happen here is the quieting of the chief of police, the silencing, not of the lamb, silencing of the chief of police. And all you'll hear coming from chief of police are good things. You'll never hear a criticism of city government. You'll never hear a criticism of anything. It'll all be good things. I submit, folks, that's wrong. That does not provide for an informed community. It does not provide for an informed electorate. And I just tell you that you should vote no on Proposition F. And let me just say this in closing, and I'm going to open up the question and answer. This is not for me. I have no stake in this. Believe it or not, I am going to retire, not on June 2nd, as some media people have been passing around. I want you to know my date hasn't changed. Sometime late in June, and let me just tell you why it is that there are those who want me out so badly. They're on the horns of a dilemma. Think about this. They're on the horns of a dilemma. They want Proposition F to pass. They want it in the worst way. But if it passes, and if I were to stay after the election was certified, guess what? You have to go through the entire selection process again. That's the reason they want me out as quickly as they can possibly get me out. They don't tell you that. They come up with all of these other reasons. That's the reason, folks. Get him out of here as quickly as possible, because these days we got to go through that selection process again. Again. Horns of a dilemma. Horns of a dilemma. Haven't heard much of that, have you? And one last comment, as I said, this is not for me. has nothing to do with me, absolutely nothing to do with me. You ask, why am I so interested? I'm interested because I love this department. I would have spent 43 years of my life in this department, 14 years as chief of police if I did not love this department, if I did not believe in this organization. Absolutely would not have. And that's why I'm here today. That's why I've stayed. That's why I fought so much of the leadership in this city, because I did not think it was good. We have a small police department. Why do we have a small police department? Because we have leadership in the city that's kept it small. I know we're blamed for not doing something about the civil unrest, but let me tell you, folks, 36 hours it lasted. 36 hours. It's been dubbed the biggest civil disorder in this century, and it lasted 36 hours, only 36 hours, and we are the smallest police department in the country for the population and area we serve. The last one in 1965 lasted 5 days. You tell me we didn't do a good job? Yeah, we made a mistake or two. And so did they in the Gulf War. All the planning that went on in the Gulf War, of all the preparation that went on in the Gulf War, of all waiting for the invasion to take place, all of that, there were mistakes, and they were fatal mistakes, serious mistakes. But once again, I tell you that you need to think before you vote for this. You need to think whether you really believe that what's been happening in the city is good and has been positive, something that you are proud of. But whether you look at the city right now and say, I don't want to rebuild it. I want to build it into something worthwhile. I don't want it rebuilt to what it was before. That's what we ought to be looking at. But we're not. We're thinking about rebuilding. I think we ought to think about a lot of things. And one of the things is you don't change the fundamental law without really giving it deep consideration, and you cannot the way it's put on the ballot. With that, I'll open up any questions you have.
Because of our town hall on the air radio show, which we're taping for delayed broadcast, I will be repeating your question. I'll begin with the first question. The gentleman's asking, why did you delay your resignation and why did you not resign in April when you said you were going to?
Well, first let me clarify, I'm not resigning, I'm retiring. There's a big difference in that. I think, at least I hope it'll be a difference in terms of my pension, which I could have collected a long, long time ago. I max out at 30 years. I stayed 13 years too long. I indicated I was going to retire in April because I was told by city councils they were going to hold a special election on this issue. I said right from the very beginning, look, you guys, first of all, you've got to decide whether or not you want this on the ballot. Secondly, you've got to decide about the selection process before I retire. And they indicated that they were going to have a special election. They told me at first they were going to have it at the end of the year. I said, fine, I'll be out sometime in the early part of the year. Then they said, we'll do it right after the first of the year. And I said, fine. I gave them plenty of time. I said, okay, I'll leave sometime in April. And then in their wisdom, they said, no, we're going to keep it on the June ballot. And I said, fine, I'll retire after the election. So nothing has changed. The information you received is that I've changed my mind. I did not change my mind right from the very beginning. I said, I want to be here for that election. Just have it, and I'll be gone.
Yes. would you respond to Lieutenant Mike Mullen's comment that you sold him down the river, according to the question?
You know, at about 10:15 last night, I got a call from the Los Angeles Times, and how would you like to have a call at 10:15 in the evening from the Los Angeles Times? I can't stand a call from that outfit at any time, and for 10:15 is anyway, and they asked me a question about, first of all, I've not mentioned the lieutenant's name. That name has been brought up by the media right from the very beginning. I did not and have not sold anyone down the river. I think that some mistakes were made initially. I think a lieutenant made some mistakes. I think initially when he pulled some people out, I think he made a very good judgment, a very sound judgment. I'm not critical of that. I am critical of the failure to move people out, to pour them in riot control mode much more quickly. I've not singled him out other than he was the field commander, he was a lieutenant on the scene, and I've also said that the mistakes that he made were not corrected by those above him, and they've come in under criticism too. I don't mind taking all the criticism in the Los Angeles Police Department. That doesn't bother me in the least, and I'm kind of used to it. But it seems to me that people within the organization have to accept when things go wrong, they have to accept the share of share of the blame. My concern it was and continues to be that there were those who believed that the police officers and the sergeants who were in the field were failing to respond for some other reason. And I needed to make that clear because they were hurting. You folks have to understand, these officers in their automobiles, in their cars, they didn't see the Reginald Denny tape. I didn't see the Reginald Denny tape. Most of us who were there in the field did not see the Reginald Denny tape as you did. I can tell you, that any one of our police officers, including the lieutenant, singly, as they saw that tape, as they saw that taking place, any one of them would have gotten a black and white, and regardless of what the people were doing, they would have done their very best to get there. When they saw that, they were devastated. They were devastated. They were hurt. And I had to come and say, look, it was not their fault. They had been pulled back. And they had not been redeployed. And they were only following instructions.
Question in the back of the room here. Yes, sir. Yes. The comment on the book of Sergeant Kuhn and taking pride in kicking a man in the groin, as the questioner refers to this quote.
Well, you know, clearly my feeling about it is the same as yours. It's trash. And I don't know whether he's trying to develop a case of stress for a pension or not. I don't understand it at all. It's unbelievable. I was critical of the Times for releasing it right at this particular point in history when emotions are so high, but I realize that can't blame them. If they hadn't done it, somebody else would. It's the lowest common denominator in the media. It is trash. You can talk to any young police officer and any police officer out there, and they'll tell you exactly the same thing. That's baloney. They're angry about it, and I think we all have a right to be angry.
Yes. Would you comment on the questioner's hearing of the loss of support for President Bush because of, quote, naive statements that he made following the riots in Los Angeles?
Well, you know, I have great respect for George Bush. I met him when he was vice president and helped him formulate a policy on drugs and dangerous drugs in this country, and I think he's followed along very, very well in that particular field. But I must tell you, I was disappointed in the speech that he made, very disappointed in the speech he made. Now, folks, think about it. A lot of anger over the Rodney King affair. A lot of people have said to me over so many things that have occurred in recent past, you have a right to be angry, Chief. And I hear this about the people in the community, you have a right to be angry over what occurred in that courtroom. I heard the President of the United States being angry over what occurred in that courtroom. We don't have a right to be angry. That's not one of our inalienable rights. Anger is corrosive. Anger seeks vengeance. Anger does not solve anything. Nothing at all. And I heard the President of the United States stand up and talk about that particular trial and say that he could not explain it. I heard the mayor of the city do exactly the same. We can't explain it, and we're not going to accept it. Folks, that is our system of justice. Whether you like it or not, whether you like the decision or not, that is our system of justice. And
we're going to have to cut it off there. Folks probably don't recall much about the Rodney King case, but the defense in that trial was, in a way, was absolutely brilliant. They used kind of the use of force continuum idea, which I'm not a big fan of. I think you ought to resolve these issues based on reasonable force. But anyway, what they kind of showed that Rodney King was in charge of this. He did this, we did that, then he did this, we did that, he did this. He kept escalating the situation. If you know the situation, they hit him more than 50 times with PR-20 or batons, police batons, broke his jaw and all kinds of things. There were more than 20 police officers there at the scene of this particular incident. And had the two highway patrol officers probably been left in charge of that, the L.A. police showed up and said, we'll take charge of this. Had they been left alone, you probably would have never heard of this case because they'd already taken one guy from the car and put him inside. But anyway, it's a long story. The officers were acquitted. And that's what President Bush was referring to. I brought a guy once to speak in Oklahoma, Scott D. McClatchy, who knew a lot about the case and worked in the L.A. PD Sheriff's Department, so was a lawyer. But anyway, that's for tonight. We'll be seeing you again. Look at the show billing and see what's going to be going on next week. We'll meet again.
Again, don't know when, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you always do. Till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know. Tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing. We'll meet again. Don't know when, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.